a handful of billionaires.
Just so, let me just be clear, is there anybody else on this stage who's not a capitalist?
Well, let me just follow up on that, Anderson, because when I think about capitalism, I think about all the small businesses that were started because we have the opportunity and the freedom in our country for people to do that and to make a good living for themselves and their families. And I don't think we should confuse what we have to do every so often in America, which is save capitalism from itself.
And we are going to leave it there. That was, of course, Hillary Clinton responding to Bernie Sanders. I want to thank our guests, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Les Payne, who's writing a book on Malcolm X, Dee Watkins, who wrote the book, The B-Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, and Zed Jelani, staff writer at Alternet. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Red Umbrella film series hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, Inside Her Sex will be shown Sunday, October 18th at 7 p.m. While we live in a highly sexualized society, the messaging around female sexuality is distorted and rife with shame. Inside Her Sex is a thought-provoking, feature-length documentary that explores female sexuality and shame through the eyes and experiences of three women. Again, that's Inside Her Sex at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at cstpdx.com/schedule.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hemp Stock Harvest Festival, October 17th and 18th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. Portland's annual Hemp Stock Harvest Festival in Portland, Oregon, advocates decriminalization of cannabis for medicinal, industrial, and recreational use. It will feature food vendors, guest speakers, and live music, including a performance by John Trudell and Bad Dog. Again, that's the Hemp Stock Harvest Festival, October 17th and 18th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local environmentalists stand up to a planned natural gas terminal on the Oregon coast.
We look into a new report showing a significant decline in the prosecution of corporate misconduct.
And Portland City Council hears testimony about a possible tax on home demolitions as the city faces an unprecedented increase in demolitions this year.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 14th, 2015. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. In the last week, opposition to a natural gas pipeline to be built through Coos Bay has heated up as a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has approved use of eminent domain to acquire land to build the pipeline. Eminent domain is a process by which landowners are forced to sell their land to a pre-negotiated purchaser. Today, protesters arrived in front of the offices of FERC to register their objection. One woman was dressed as Oregon Governor Kate Brown and rallied the crowd against the project and its parent company, a Canadian corporation called Veresen. KBOO's Paul Rowland recorded the event.
So, Governor Brown, what is this notice of condemnation that you're holding? Well, you see, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is willing to use their power of eminent domain to condemn private property and in the state for like an export pipeline. And no matter how you feel about private property, I think it's very clear that an export pipeline that would and a plant liquefaction plant that would become the largest polluter is a terrible idea for Oregon.
So you're going to take this to FERC, I take it?
Absolutely. We're going straight into FERC, and we're just letting them know that I'm standing with the rest of Oregonians in opposing LNG exports in the state of Oregon.
Loud and clear. We don't
in the state of Oregon, there are multiple proposed LNG export facilities. And this means that multinational corporations have proposed to build pipelines in the state of Oregon, build them through fire-prone areas, build them through earthquake and tsunami zones, and export fracked natural gas in our state. These corporations are willing to use the power of FERC and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, is willing to give them permission to use eminent domain to seize private property for their pipelines. It's really clear that eminent domain, which is a mechanism supposed to be used for the public good of a state, is an inappropriate thing to use when it comes to multinational corporations building pipelines in our state.
That's right.
Yeah. Are there any questions?
Why is this pipeline not in the public good?
Well, absolutely. For anyone who hasn't been following the situation, let's be totally clear. This pipeline cuts a 100-foot swath through Oregon Forest. It crosses over or under 400 different waterways. It goes through some of the most forest fire-prone area in the country, as well as some of, like, literally, Coos Bay, Oregon is one of the most earthquake-prone spaces in our entire country, and one of the tsunami-prone spaces in the entire country. And rural Oregonians do not need a pipeline of explosive natural gas passing through their places. We don't need it in our backyards, and they don't need it in their forests, and they don't need it under their rivers. So, stand with me in resisting LNG export in the state of Oregon. All right, everyone, is everyone ready to go in? Yay! Bonnie, if you're here, can you raise your hand?
I'm in an elevator headed to the fifth floor, headed to the offices of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Thank you, Kate, for protecting our state. Thank you, Kate, for protecting our state. Thank you, Kate, for protecting our state.
But we know that it's not necessarily what you do in this office. We just want you to let the people at FERC know in Washington, D.C. that I'm going to use all my gubernatorial powers to kick FERC out of Oregon. Here you go.
Hey, everybody. Yo, yo, governor's talking.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, on the count of three, we're just going to end this on a positive note. On the count of three, no LNG. One, two, three.
No LNG! Woo!
That was audio from a rally today against liquefied natural gas terminals on the Oregon coast. The rally featured a puppet pretending to be Governor Kate Brown. The puppet took a stand against natural gas pipelines and terminals in Oregon. The actual governor has yet to take a stand on the issue.
New research indicates that the melting permafrost in the Arctic could cost the world up to $43 trillion. This research is an attempt to put a cumulative bill on the economic damage that would result from a loss of permafrost. The staggering cost is approximately equal to the combined gross national products of the U.S., China, Japan, Germany, U.K., France, and Brazil. This attempt to put a cumulative economic value on climate change is part of the bid to get governments to take climate change seriously. Two economists from the University of Chicago and the University of Colorado have put together this latest attempt to price the impact of rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and the continuous rise in average global temperatures. The Arctic is the fastest warming region of the planet. The two scientists now report that if emissions of greenhouse gases continue to rise as they are doing now, the thaw of permafrost and the loss of the ice caps could release 1,700 billion metric tons of carbon, now locked in the Arctic as frozen organic matter. That means a higher chance of catastrophic floods, windstorms, heat waves, and droughts. The accelerated melting of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, rising sea levels, loss of agricultural land, and rising energy demand. So the total cost of permafrost thaw would be $43 trillion, which is about half of the planet's current wealth. If nothing is done to mitigate climate change, the cost could rise even higher.
Portland is having one of the driest seasons since 1987, and as a result, has been using its reserve water supply for over 90 days straight. Most Portland water comes from Bull Run. When the reservoir runs short, the city begins pulling from its reserves that are fed by aquifers. Currently, Bull Run has about half the water that it normally does at this time of year. While water levels are lower than previous years, it is expected that we will be able to meet the demand without problems. The Water Bureau expects spring rains to refill the reservoir in time for next summer. On average, a few inches of rain are capable of significantly impacting water levels.
Nine publicly owned utility companies have brought suit against the Oregon Department of Energy. They say that a fee assessed by the department amounts to a tax and is therefore illegal. The fee, which pays for about a third of the department's budget in a typical year, is assessed based on the money brought in by all energy suppliers. By Oregon law, taxes must be passed by a 3/5 majority in the state house. The department would also have to submit a detailed accounting of how it would spend the money. This is the second time in recent years that the Department of Energy has come under fire for the same fee. In 2012, PacifiCorp and Cascade Natural Gas sued the department on similar grounds, saying that nobody knows what the money pays for. The legislature responded by passing a law requiring more transparency. The fee was also lowered for 1 year. This threw DOE's finances into chaos and resulted in huge budget cuts at the state agency. The Department of Energy told the Oregonian it had not heard about the complaint and had no comment.
According to a finding from Oregon's Labor Commission, your Uber driver is not an independent contractor, despite the company's claims to the contrary. Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian found that people who drive for the ride-sharing company are, in fact, employees. That means they're entitled to a minimum wage, workers' compensation, and other protections. Uber executives seemed taken aback by the decision, asserting that Avakian's decision came out of the blue and was based on bad information. This is just the latest scene in an ongoing drama that has at times pitted Uber against Oregon politicians and cab drivers. Uber attempted to launch in Portland without permission from city mandarins back in 2014, only to be slapped down after wrangling over regulations, during which Commissioner Steve Novick compared the company to the Third Reich. It's unclear at this point what the labor commissioner's findings might mean for the company's future here in Oregon.
The Portland City Council today voted against amending the regulations for marijuana retail licensing to make it easier for medical marijuana dispensaries to convert to recreational retailers. Here's some of the testimony from today's hearing, beginning with Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
The amendments that we have on the table, first of all, amend the hours of operations from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. to 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. In line with recently adopted Oregon Liquor Control Commission, OLCC rules. So that's our first amendment. We haven't heard too much controversy over that one. The second one that we published on Friday provides for additional business dispensaries that are currently operating and allows for them to convert to have a 5-day business day window to convert from a medical dispensary to a recreational dispensary, essentially jumping the queue. And so those were the amendments that we have on the table.
My name is Jason McGrew. I had a marijuana dispensary on 46 and Hawthorne for over a year. When the regulations came out, there was two of us. The Canna Connection is across the street. They were around the corner on 46 and Hawthorne, and I was right on the street. Anyway, when the 1,000-foot rule came out, we had to race to register, and they beat me by 3 minutes. So they were grandfathered in, or they got their license, and I didn't. I've been paying on that lease, waiting for recreational to open up and make it fair. I really hope Commissioner Saltzman's agenda comes through and you guys make it fair to everybody. All the grandfathering in I'm hearing would be eliminated if you just made it a fair market. The people that already exist could stay existing, and new business could apply as well to share the market. Otherwise, you're just giving them a neighborhood and a lockdown. And it just seems really unfair to me.
That was testimony from today's city council meeting about marijuana dispensaries in the city. The City Council will revisit the issue in its next meeting since they were unable to come to an agreement at today's meeting.
The Portland City Council also discussed potential changes to the process of permitting demolitions of residential properties around the city. Concerns about the effects of demolitions sparked a conversation about extending notification periods and increasing the cost of demolitions throughout the city. Those concerns included increased rents, release of asbestos and other contaminants into the air, and reduced quality of life. Previous efforts by the city to extend demolition waiting periods and to incentivize deconstructions have proven to be unworkable and ineffective. The council heard testimony regarding a new proposed demolition tax today in council chambers. Janet Baker, Barbara Strunk, and Margaret Davis of United Neighborhoods for Reform gave proposed amendments for the city's proposed demolition tax and rebate structure.
My name's Janet Baker, and I'm part of United Neighborhoods for Reform, and I live in Northeast Portland. So finally, the city proposes an alternative approach to curbing demolitions, a demolition tax. The tax is intended to play two roles. First, it's intended to disincentivize demolitions. Secondly, it would provide some funding for low-income housing initiatives, a greatly underserved part of the Portland community. Hundreds more houses will be demolished in Portland and replaced with oversized suburban-style tract homes that only a very small fraction of Portland home buyers can afford. The only beneficiaries of the demolition boom have been the developers. They've made many millions of dollars on the backs of Portland homeowners and renters. In addition, demolitions have destroyed many viable, affordable homes and apartments in Portland at a time when affordable housing is becoming increasingly hard to find. The money collected from this proposed demolition tax would go into a fund to address affordable housing issue. We believe it's only fair that the beneficiaries of the boom, the developers, should help pay for some of the negative externalities of their actions.
Hello, my name is Barbara Strunk. I'm a member of United Neighborhoods for Reform, and I live in Northeast Portland. UNR does support the idea of a demolition tax to try to curb the number of demolitions of single-family homes. We do not support the current proposed tax as it stands, mainly with the rebates offered if two houses are built in place of one. The original form of the tax, with no rebates, has credibility, but we think it can be better. What we think will happen if this current tax is enacted is that the number of demolitions of viable single-family residences will increase. Rebates will encourage demolitions and lot divisions. We will see greatly increased lot divisions and demolitions, especially in neighborhoods like Kenton, where nearly all the houses have underlying historical lot lines and are still somewhat affordable. We don't want to see any of these possibilities happen.
I'm Margaret Davis with United Neighborhoods for Reform. I live in Northeast Portland. The simple structure of UNR's revised tax, $35,000 flat tax on both demolitions and major remodels, will achieve the aim of protecting affordable housing and amassing funding for more. Minus exemptions, rebates, and loopholes, the revised tax is also far easier to administer. Under the demo delay rules, no house has been saved. Same with deconstruction. That voluntary program, which involves giving money to developers to do the right thing by foregoing wasteful and hazardous mechanical demolition, has had no takers since it was instituted. And in fact, staff encouraged an application just this week from somebody, but that house is already gone. Such non-results highlight the need for real ones. One constant in these underwhelming measures so far was heavy influence by members of the Development Review Advisory Committee, or DRAC. DRAC, which includes many developers, does an excellent job of finessing permitting processes. This demo tax is not one. We have been assured by the mayor on Monday that any changes, revisions made to this tax will go through the revenue department, and we hope through transparent process. We're counting on it. Demolitions take it all away. The affordable housing, mature urban trees, character and history, and uncontaminated dirt and air, among other irreplaceable assets of our community. This is your third try at curbing demolitions. Please make it matter. Commissioner Fritz, you led the charge against smoking in the parks. You should be against demolitions. They spread lead and asbestos, which cause health effects similar to smoking, maybe even worse. Commissioner Saltzman, You care about children through your children's levy. The Centers for Disease Control says there's no amount of lead that's safe in children, and bulldozed homes exude lead. Commissioner Novick, you care about waste and resource waste and climate change. There's no way you can recoup the carbon cost of throwing an old-growth home in the dumpster. Commissioner Fish, if you care about affordable housing and aging in place, these are homes that serve generations of Portlanders and could have served many more. So thank you again for bringing this demolition tax forward. And we hope, Council, that you will consider a revised tax that will actually work. Thank you.
Barbara Strunk and Margaret Davis of United Neighborhoods for Reform were giving testimony regarding the city's proposed demolition tax. After hearing that testimony for a few hours this afternoon, the issue was tabled.
One of the most powerful persons in Oregon history, possibly the most powerful person, John Kitzhaber, is now a private citizen criticizing the press. The former governor issued a statement to the Salem Statesman Journal accusing the Oregonian of massaging facts to fit a, quote, predetermined narrative. The stories in question were published in April, 2 months after Kitzhaber's administration came crashing down in a stunning political scandal. The scandal was sparked by the leak of thousands of Kitzhaber's emails, which appeared to paint a picture of influence peddling and gross nepotism. Kitzhaber accuses the Oregonian of inserting false information into some of the emails they printed. The Oregonian quietly retracted aspects of the stories in September, months after the inaccuracies came to light.
Fred Meyers has announced that as of January 1st, its employee health care coverage will begin covering transgender medical care. The company has set a $100,000 lifetime limit on services, which for most people would be able to cover mental health, hormonal therapy, and transition surgeries. Fred Meyers is the fourth largest retailer, and so far the largest retailer to offer such benefits. Studies have shown that people with gender identity issues are more prone to homelessness, poverty, and suicide. The move comes at a time when gender identity is largely being accepted as a mental health issue, and more employers and state programs are reaching out to provide services for transgendered individuals. Fred Meyer's new changes will also ensure that employees receive biologically correct care, which includes services and checkups after surgeries. According to a 2011 survey, there are approximately 700,000 transgendered individuals in the United States, and statistically, about 40% attempt suicide. New health plans that purposely consider transgender issues may improve unemployment, homelessness, and suicide rates in the transgender community.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Tune in after this newscast at 5:45 for an extended interview with Rising Tide activist Emmalyn Garrett, who was one of a group of activists to hike the entire 232-mile stretch of a proposed gas pipeline through Oregon. This will be followed by Right to Survive Radio at 6. Tonight, we feature a report from the U.S. Social Forum and a visit to the Jungle, a 10-year-long houseless encampment in San Jose that was recently evicted. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is mixed clouds and sunshine with a high of 78, moving to partly cloudy and 53 at night. Today in history, on October 14, 1912, President Theodore Roosevelt was shot and wounded in an assassination attempt, but delivered an entire speech before receiving treatment. The quote of the day is from Mark Twain, who said, "When we remember we are all mad, the mysteries disappear and life stands explained."
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The negotiations and the sales push behind Washington's latest and biggest free trade agreement amount to Kabuki theater. What theater? Kabuki. It's a 17th century form of Japanese drama, featuring elaborate sets and costuming, rhythmic dialogue, and stylized acting and dancing. That does sum up the White House's production of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Its negotiations have been set in luxury resorts around the world, covered by elaborate secrecy. Insiders wear the costumes of global corporate power, while trade officials parrot rhythmic dialogue about incredible benefits for all. and the president himself is the main actor, dramatically proclaiming that TPP is the most progressive trade deal ever. And now he's doing a stylized political dance in hopes of winning congressional approval. What a show! But it doesn't seem to be selling. Recent polls show broad public opposition to any more of these trade schemes, not only among Democrats, but independents and Republicans too. 10 of the 2016 presidential candidates are opposed, led by Democratic contender Bernie Sanders, who calls it flat-out disastrous, and GOP frontrunner Donnie Trump, who dubs it a horrible deal. Congressional opposition is strong, and even Ford Motor Company, which was one of the corporate giants allowed inside the negotiations, has blasted it, calling on Congress to vote no. This is Jim Hightower saying, inexplicably, Obama views passage of this democracy-strangling corporate boondoggle as his legacy-making achievement, even though the only real support he has for it are Republican congressional leaders and the global corporate establishment. That's not just kabuki, it's kooky. As the old aphorism puts it, tell me with whom you walk, and I'll tell you who you are. To keep track and get involved, go to citizen.org/trade.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A U.S. District Court jury in Madison has ruled that Apple infringed on a technology patent held by the University of Wisconsin. The claim was brought by the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, who also sued Intel Corp. over the same patent in 2008 and settled for an undisclosed amount. KBOO's Joe Aaron has more.
According to court documents, the university filed a patent in 1998 regarding a technology that improves the way that chips process data. The university sued Intel in 2008 and settled out of court. Apple may be fined over $800 million for violating the patent unless they manage to settle out of court. Apple defense attorneys argued the patent is invalid, but a judge disagreed, saying that processors found in iPhone 5, 6, and 6 Plus, as well as several versions of the iPad, do indeed violate the patent held by the University of Wisconsin. The next trial phase is to determine the damages and a trial to determine if Apple's violation of the patent was willful. If the court finds that Apple infringement was intentional, then it can significantly increase the amount of the fine. Patent lawsuits have become increasingly common in the current era of modern technology. Many university science programs rely on selling and enforcing patents in order to create more revenue for research. Some of these patents from universities across the country are leased out or put up for sale, although that does not appear to be the case in the University of Wisconsin patent. Companies eager to make a profit have begun an industry of buying patents with no intention of using them, but instead waiting for another company to come up with the idea and then sue them for violating the patent. These opportunistic business practices frequently lead to small-scale business being sued, and in many cases are settled out of court due to the cost of defending the accusations. Lawmakers have been scrambling to create new laws that make it harder to file patent suits. Unfortunately, these laws affect the way that universities handle their patents and can make it harder for schools to defend a major source of research money. This has led to technology companies being pitted against universities. Last year, a patent troll began suing podcasters, claiming that the company had a patent on the digital distribution of audio. Corolla Digital spent $500,000 defending itself from the patent troll. Because the case was settled out of court, Corolla Digital gave up its right to pursue legal fees from the patent troll suing them. It should be noted that while many universities are not actually engaged in patent trolling, their need to market their patents for research money creates a situation that is frequently abused, making it hard to write laws that treat both sides fairly. In April of this year, 200 technology companies wrote an open letter to universities asking them to reevaluate how patents are handled. Many of the patent companies are owned by various alumni associations. While most universities oppose patent trolling, many also oppose the current reforms in interest of protecting their intellectual property. From KBOO News, I'm Joe Aaron.
The number of corporations being criminally prosecuted has declined by nearly 30% despite an increase in referrals to the U.S. Department of Justice regarding corporate crime. That statistic comes courtesy of a new study from the Transactional Record Access Clearinghouse. KABU reporter Robin Ryan spoke with their co-founder, David Burnham, about the challenges in obtaining the data, which required 17 years and three separate lawsuits to get.
What's the biggest difference that you see between what the Department of Justice says and what it ultimately chooses to do as it pertains to cracking down on corporate crime?
In this case, the Justice Department officials and FBI officials for many years have claimed that they are deeply concerned about combating corporate crime. This includes Eric Holder and Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, who gave a talk a couple of months ago, and where she says the lawbreakers must be kept accountable no matter whether they commit their crime on the street corners or the boardrooms. The FBI says much the same thing for many years, and they aren't doing this. The data shows that only 0.2% of all federal prosecutions from more than 10 years were aimed at corporations. Not only is it a very small number, that number is declining. It's down by about a third in the last 10 years. So what this is strong evidence that the Justice Department is not doing what they claim they're doing.
Is there a point in time you can look to and say this is when it changed and this is when the Department of Justice stopped prosecuting corporate criminals?
I don't think that they ever have done much on corporations. What's different is that we now have the data to look at it.
In August 2008, a high-ranking official with the Department of Justice, I believe it was Deputy Attorney General Mark Phillip, issued a 21-page document entitled Principles of Federal Prosecutions of Business Organizations. This altered the guidelines for how to address crimes committed by corporations. How would you characterize the impact now, six, seven years later?
It's major. It was clearly a very influential policy paper. There is a problem, however. Some years before that, when the Justice Department prosecuted Arthur B. Anderson, it went into bankruptcy, and a lot of people lost their jobs. And this event, and some others like it, led the Justice Department to think about this, and they came up with their alternative plan to not prosecuting.
Was there a widespread use of deferred non-prosecution agreements prior to this shift in policy? It seems to me lately, over the last few years, especially as it applies to the financial services industry, all of these settlements, it seems the Department of Justice has become this revenue-generating source instead of an agency charged with enforcing and applying the rule of law.
No question that the use of this non-prosecution policy has gone up. It began in 2004 only one or two times. It's now gotten to be 100 or so. So it's gone up, and we see what's happened to General Motors, and one wonders, will there ever be a criminal prosecution of Volkswagen and their cheating on the diesel thing? We don't know. And the question is, criminal prosecutions are meant to deter future actions. And can these agreements actually make the big corporations change their ways? Or is it necessary, in fact, to have a few actual prosecutions? It's not an easy question. We don't make light of the challenge here. But I think we need more discussion. And because the Justice Department for years has resisted making this information public from their own computers, it was impossible to see what was going on. Now we can see. Now let's have a discussion of this. Let's have a debate in the Congress about whether this is appropriate.
What would you contend at this point are the most expedient forms of remedying these dynamics?
Well, I keep going back to our hopes that effective oversight in a representative democracy like the United States, that we can change this. And we have examples over the years where that is true. I myself, for example, worked on a huge police corruption problem in New York 30 years ago, and it resulted in the appointment of a very effective commission. A lot of changes were made in the law, new bosses were brought in, and it really changed what happened. So I think you can find examples where good oversight, in fact, have improved the working of the government. There's no way to measure white-collar crime or corporate crime. Statisticians have been unable to do that. It's very complicated. But what is interesting is that during the period when corporate prosecutions were going down, the number of corporations was going up. So there's a conflict there, raising big questions.
For me, the biggest stat there was the jump in the number of limited liability corporations. What about this particular corporate model is so appealing?
The partnerships are very, very hard to deal with. And in fact, this has become a worse problem because Congress, in its wisdom, have reduced the budget of the IRS substantially in the last 4 or 5 years. So you don't have the same number of smart investigators out there looking for it, and the partnerships are much harder to examine than a regular corporation.
I've been talking with David Burnham. He is the co-founder and co-director of the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Protests took place this weekend in Cleveland, Ohio, after prosecutors released their report of two supposed experts who declared that police acted reasonably when they shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice last year. A lawyer for Rice's family said the grand jury hearing currently underway could result in a situation like the one in Ferguson, Missouri, following the killing of Michael Brown. Last year, a grand jury in Ferguson decided not to indict white police officer Darren Wilson for the shooting death of unarmed black teen Michael Brown. The actions of prosecutor Robert McCulloch came under scrutiny as he made unusual decisions such as providing huge amounts of unrelated evidence to the grand jury. The grand jury was treated as a trial rather than being criticized by people across the country. In Cleveland, many local residents are calling for the state prosecutor to step down after calling only two expert witnesses, one of whom was a district attorney and the other a retired FBI agent. On Saturday, the prosecutor released reports from these so-called experts who said that Officer Timothy Lohman acted reasonably when he opened fire on Tamir, who had been playing with a fake gun on a playground. He was shot by police 2 seconds after they got out of their car.
Two Hillsborough police officers will stand trial on charges of excessive use of force after a judge declined to dismiss their case. 3 years ago, Officer William Blood, who was white, stopped a black bicyclist named Jermaine Robinson for riding his bicycle at night without a headlight. Blood demanded that Robinson give his name, and when Robinson was slow to reply, Blood called for backup. Officer Brian Wilbur arrived within a minute. On orders from Blood, Wilbur then shot Jermaine Robinson repeatedly with a taser, once after he had even fallen to the ground. The judge hearing the case found that Robinson had committed only minor and nonviolent offenses in the lead-up to the taser attack. She then declined to dismiss the case, which will soon go to trial.
Conservative pundits have been quick to cite the so-called Ferguson effect as responsible for a spike in violent crime. The theory is that police are afraid to police aggressively for fear of sparking protests like those that exploded in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson last summer after the death of an unarmed black teenager at the hands of a white police officer. According to recent reports, however, the Ferguson effect is an illusion. Many cities have in fact seen decreases in violent crime over the last year. Where there have been increases, the causes are various. In Chicago, the main culprit appears to be the availability of guns. Chicago police confiscate 8 times as many guns per capita as police in more peaceful New York City. The violent crime rate in the city has skyrocketed since a series of court decisions weakened its gun laws. Segregation and prolonged poverty have also been cited as significant factors by some experts.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, October 14th, 2015. Two Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli soldiers in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, a third Palestinian died while being held by the Israeli army as a political detainee. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
On Wednesday, Bassem Bassam Sidir, 17, was shot dead at Damascus Gate in occupied East Jerusalem on Wednesday after he allegedly pulled out a knife, Israeli police and media said, although no one but the teenager was injured or killed. Sidir was from the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Eyewitnesses reported that the army fired more than 10 rounds at the 17-year-old as he was running away, killing him. Meanwhile, Ahmed Abu Sha'ban, 23, was shot dead on Wednesday evening by Israeli soldiers near the central bus station in West Jerusalem. The Israeli police allege that he stabbed and lightly wounded a 50-year-old settler woman. The circumstances of his death remains unknown until the time of this report. Earlier on Wednesday morning, Fadi Ad-Darabi, 30, from Jenin City, died while being detained in Israeli army detention camp for political prisoners. Ad-Darabi suffered a brain stroke earlier in Rimon prison and was left unconscious in the prison courtyard's floor for 20 minutes after he suffered internal brain injury. After that, he was transferred to Soroka Hospital. His health had deteriorated since then. 2 years ago, Ad-Darabi suffered from internal bleeding and the Israeli prison service did not offer him any medical follow-up. Ad-Darabi was imprisoned in 2006 and was sentenced to 14 years. He was moved several times to different jails. Also on Wednesday, clashes were reported in different parts of the West Bank and Gaza. In the coastal region, 18 civilians were injured, including 3 by live rounds, when Israeli troops attacked protesters at border areas near Al Buraj refugee camp in central Gaza. Moreover, 52 Palestinians have been injured during ongoing clashes between local youth and invading Israeli soldiers in West Bank communities, Palestinian sources reported. Clashes were reported in the central West Bank city of Ramallah, Nablus and Qalqilya in the north of the West Bank, and in the southern West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Hebron. Since October 1st, 33 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,600 others injured by Israeli troops, according to Palestinian medical sources. Earlier report by the Ministry of Health showed that since the start of October, 4,000 residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation fired by Israeli troops targeting Palestinian protesters. In other news, Israeli settlers on Wednesday set fire to large Palestinian-owned agricultural land near the village of Burin to the south of Nablus in the West Bank and injured a British activist while hurling stones at them, according to local sources. Since the beginning of October, settlers have been attacking Palestinians on the main roads, stoning their vehicles. The settlers who live in northern West Bank have also been carrying out early morning and late night attacks against vulnerable communities in remote villages. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 14, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the U.S. launched 63 airstrikes over the weekend in Afghanistan. An unknown number of people were killed in the attacks. The Afghan Taliban has pulled back from the northern city of Kunduz in order to protect civilians, but declared this was not a sign of defeat. In addition to fighting U.S. special forces and the Afghan military, the Taliban is now taking on Daesh, the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which has started gaining influence in eastern Afghanistan. While pulling back from Kunduz, the Taliban has threatened to take over. Fighting has flared in eastern Afghanistan as Taliban insurgents threaten to storm Ghazni, another provincial capital in eastern Afghanistan. The Afghan government claims that 29 border officers were killed when their base was overrun by Taliban fighters.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Aaron, Joseph Jordan, Jimmy Tardy, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on K2A2BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Democracy Now!, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Ajamu Umi with the All Africans People Revolutionary Party, Ricky Muhammad with the Nation of Islam, and John Slaughter with Black Lives Matter about the Million Man March 20th anniversary event last weekend in Washington, D.C. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fagerang has an update on African politics and the draining of resources, as well as an update on the attempted coup in Burkina Faso and more. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Dave Mazza interviews Lauren Groff, award-winning author, about her new book, Fates and Furies, a novel about marriage, creativity, art, and perception. And at 11:30, Mark Crispin Miller talks about the Forbidden Bookshelf, and Peter Hart talks about the recent Banned Book Week. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. You can always become a member or renew by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.